C1PR. Number 23A.
Now we come to the Lord's Prayer. And the Lord's Prayer is introduced here. And Mrs. Eddy says, here, let me give what I understand to be the spiritual sense of the Lord's Prayer. She says here, what is the spiritual sense of the Lord's Prayer? She doesn't say, let me give here the spiritual interpretation of the Lord's Prayer. And I feel there is quite a point in this, if one considers, as I will do right now, the Lord's Prayer as the prayer which stands at the end of the chapter on prayer. If one has it placed at that point and considers it as the ending point or as the climaxing point of the whole chapter on prayer, I feel it's quite a point that she says, I give here the spiritual sense of the prayer. Because, you know, in the manual she says that in the church is read the Lord's Prayer audibly, and then its spiritual interpretation. And that what she gives here in italics is her spiritual interpretation. But taken as a whole, not interpreting each sentence, but taking the whole Lord's Prayer as a whole, she says, let me give here the spiritual sense of it. Now, the spiritual sense of the Lord's Prayer is what? The spiritual sense is that which is against the material sense. The spiritual sense which is above selfishness. The spiritual sense which is supreme. So, what I would like to point out is the Lord's Prayer from the point of view of spiritual sense and not so much from spiritual interpretation. That's something quite different. That would be from the principal point of view, where we, well, say, if in the compendiums I did write on the Lord's Prayer, I wrote there from the spiritual interpretation of the Lord's Prayer, not from the spiritual sense of the Lord's Prayer. And you see what's the difference is? It's not interpreting what she wants to point out here is not so much the interpreting of each sentence, but to get the sense, the spiritual sense of it. And it coincides with the whole attitude which we have considered yesterday, the attitude of the whole prayer as the word, that's the word which climaxes in soul, the prayer of soul, not of material sense, where the spiritual sense prays. It isn't where we ask ourselves what really means every sentence in it. But where spiritual sense prays, and when spiritual sense prays, then it is free from the material sense, then it is a resurrected sense, then it is that sense of unselfishness which is willing really to put self away. It's again we come back to the main tone of love as that self-forgetfulness, where self is put aside. And when self is put aside, then what stands out from that point of view in the Lord's Prayer? It says, our Father, Mother, God, all harmonious. Or our Father, which art in heaven, supreme, not on earth, in heaven. And then it gives all to God, says, hallowed be thy name, adorable one. See, just from the spiritual sense, it just doesn't have anything to do with me. Just gives everything to God. That trustworthiness point which goes out from the spiritual sense, from the selflessness which says, oh, Father, which is in heaven, which is so supreme over the earth, so resurrected over all earthly things and longings and wantings and wishes, which is in the heavenly atmosphere, in the spiritual supreme atmosphere. Hallowed be thy name, adorable one, thy kingdom come, thy kingdom is come, thou art ever present. See, these three have really summarized the first three prayers. It is in the first prayer we had the seeking after God as he is, not as we think him out. It is the seeking after the Father in heaven, as he is in heaven. And then the second prayer was that devotion and worship and adoration of that God, the love for God. Here summarized, adorable one. And then in the third, we had that dry land where the third prayer took that tough position of not letting in anything which is speculative, which is sentimental, emotional, but which sticks to the rule and is firm about sticking to the rule and to the solid and sober requirements of God's being. Thy kingdom is come. Thou art ever present. But naturally we see that here it's as though they depict these first three prayers. They depict it naturally from the high climax of complete glorification. See, it's a sublimer sense than in the first, second, and third prayer. It is part of the seventh prayer, of the prayer of love, of the prayer of holiness and glorification. From the point of view of my attitude of the word of the word, where it just gives everything, trusts everything to the all. And I can only do that from the point of view of spiritual sense, where material sense is so silenced that it doesn't want anything for itself. Just shut up. All the gush of material sense is shut up. And it just says, oh no. Where it says, yes, humanly, I have this problem and that problem, and that troubles me, and this troubles me, and this should be solved, and that should be solved. But where spiritual sense says, what shall I praise? What shall I magnify? Is there anything worthwhile in all those problems? And we just shut up, the voice of those problems, and say, no, my job, my prayer is to praise God. That's my job. And I say, oh, Father, which is so above all that troubled earth, is in heaven. Hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. See, how it puts everything, all trust in God. Then comes the fourth, and there is a change. And it says, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Enable us to know, as in heaven, so on earth, God is omnipotent, supreme. Now she comes to the point of coincidence of the absolute and the relative. It is still, thy will be done. But that thy is in the absolute and relative, in heaven and on earth, in principle and in idea. It is so vast reaching that it sounds through every detail. And so my whole trust in principle is now a whole trust in the coincidence of the absolute and relative. And then we come to the fifth, sixth, and seventh, and they all have that sense that this fourth tone really, really proves itself as life, truth, and love in the relative. Then comes in the us, not the me. Jesus didn't teach his disciples to pray for their ego. It's always us. It's always all. Give us, not me. I couldn't pray, give me this daily bread. I would limit the Holy One of Israel. I would make him small and little and narrow and egoistic and personal. Says, give us this day our daily bread. Give us grace for today, feed the famished affection. Now it's us. See, then, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Can you see how the last three really show how what she said, and God calls down infinite blessings. Blessings to all, to us, not only to me. And it's the always the moment we have seen when in the subtone of love of life the floodgates of heaven are opened. And the whole blessing comes down to earth. What blessing? What does it bring? What does it bring to us? Does it bring a better salary, a better income? Does it bring this and that? It says, it brings us more grace. It feeds the famished affections. What affections? Affections for what? But it can only, love can only feel the right affections. And I come right back to my beginning of prayer, where I have again the desire to seek God. That is the affection that is fed by God. In some of the translations, they say, that's quite interesting, they say that this really should read differently. Give us the bread of life today. Or another says, give us... No, that's not here. Give us the word of life today. That's very interesting. It's not just the bread as it is taken as material bread, but it's the bread of life. That is what God can give. God can't give us that which the baker can give us. He gives us the bread of life. And the bread of life does what? It always feeds our word of life. It feeds again our affection to seek God. It feeds again our affection to love God. It feeds again our affection of the third prayer to be sincere. It feeds again our affection to be principled. and it feeds again our affection to be consecrated and have deep devotion and conviction. That's what God does and gives us. God can give only that to us which draws us near to Him. He can't give something else. He can't give something which is outside of His realm. And so, what comes down as blessing are not just benefactions. What comes down from earth are primarily and super importantly the blessings of God, of the nature of God, that it feeds our affection again to seek. That's the highest blessing I can feel I could get from God. Because if I seek, I'll find. If I find, I love it, and I begin to worship it. And I get again into the rhythm of the world. And there is no other way to God but the world. There is no other way of life, and no other life than to go the way of life. And that's the days of creation, the word of life. So it feeds and feeds me. That's one of the wonders. I was thinking so much about it. I don't know if I have talked about it yesterday. I forget what I said yesterday. But never mind. It's so nice even if I repeat it. It's a wonder to me that the more one gets hold of the ordered story of the days of creation, or the ordered story of the world of life, or the ordered story of the Christ or Christianity and science, the more one gets hold of it, the more one wants to seek it. One never gets fed up of it. It doesn't feed us so that we are getting fed up of it. It feeds the famished affection. And it always feeds, we could say, well, how long shall it feed the famished affection? Human sense says, well, it should feed us until we are satisfied, but we shall never be. Or the word of life would have an end, and God would have an end. It always feeds again the famished affection. And every time I watch myself, every time when I feel, now I have heard, if I hear anything metaphysically, I feel, now I have heard that. I feel, well, you haven't understood it. Then I say to myself, then you don't have grasped it. Because if I would have grasped it, I wouldn't say, I have heard it. And I would say, oh, that's wonderful. Oh, I go back to it, and I go back to it. And so whenever we feel, well, we have done the synonyms, then we know that we haven't grasped the synonyms. And if ever I should have the feeling I have done the chapter on prayer, then I know that I haven't grasped it. Because love feeds the famished affections. And if love doesn't do that, that it draws me always newly with a bigger intent and with a bigger love and a bigger affection back to God, then certainly something must be wrong. Because only that which draws me always again back to God and deeper into the depths of God can be of God. And only that can be good. So I watch myself in that direction. That when I get the feeling, well, we have done that, or let's hear something else now and so on, I feel, no, there's something wrong about it. It's a wonder of metaphysics, of the science of life, that one never gets enough of it. It's always feeding a famished affection. It's never feeding an affection which is already fed up of it, which has enough. And so we have the drive to go on and on and on. It's always going on in what? We can only go on in God, and in never something outside of God. And if we go on in God in science, we can only go on in the order of science, and in the ordered story of any aspect of science. That's the beautiful thing of it. We'll never be so satisfied that we'll never be hungering after God. And so it goes on and on and on. So, to make it a bit short here, I just want to take again this chapter, this Lord's Prayer, and see what does it really, in a big way, present. We see somehow that the first three tones, see, is one big approach to God. The whole sense is putting oneself aside and reaching out for the divine self or ego. Our Father, which is in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Then there is a turning point. Then we get to coincidence of the absolute and the relative. Thy will be done in earth, in heaven as it is on earth. That's the coincidence. Then we have the last three as the blessing of the earth, of the spiritual idea. Then it blesses, it feeds the famished affection. Then it is, and forgive us our debts. And then it is, and deliver us from evil. A great sense of God giving now the answer to us. And so it is, so to say, a trend to God, finding its coincidence with God, and then the answer from God. The answer through the subtone of life, truth, and love. I said, well, this is an approach from the point of view of spiritual sense, because it is an attitude. You see, it's a spiritual sense attitude, which I can't just, which is something different from the interpretation of every statement. Can you see that? It is an attitude which I can't just have. It must have been cultured through the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh prayer to the trustworthiness, where I trust everything to God, but where I trust everything to God, not just because I know I should do it, but because my spiritual sense is willing to do it and is so selfless that it just rejoices in doing it. And so it gives all to God. And then it begins to see that God and the universe is one, and then it sees that the universe just profits of all of God. And we have the last three. Now, there is only half an hour left, and so I would like to go to the last point on page 6 of the questionnaire, which I would like you to have a look at. What I have put on page 6 and 7 is really, I would say, something to think about for next time. It isn't something which is fixed and final, but which I want you to consider. And so that perhaps there is some right proportion in our study, I would perhaps say, for those who like to have an advice in study, not for the others, take the next 3 or 4 or 5 weeks and devote your thought to what we have been doing yesterday and today, to go through the 6th and the 7th prayer and through the Lord's Prayer and just pray about it and use your spiritual sense about it and go over it, and then perhaps use the rest of the time until next session to the consideration of what I have here on page 6 and 7. And when we come together, we may better know what we want to do next time. Now, what we want to do next time is naturally, when one has finished a chapter, one shouldn't leave it at that and go on to the next. Then one should see, well, now we have the elements. Now we have the tools. Now what do they mean? See, up to now, what we have done is really that we have taken the chapter on prayer and have analyzed it. We have thoroughly analyzed it to the tones and subtones and I don't know what. We have analyzed it. Now we can't leave the whole thing analyzed. We always have to put these things together again. We need the synthesis again where we put everything together to one whole again. But then this whole is a whole which is understood and which makes sense and which is something very different from where we started. So next time I would like to pull everything together again. And for that we need a lot of spiritual sense. And the culture of our spiritual sense and the tolerance against each other because we may not agree with what we may say. But in one way we may agree, and that is the questions which we have to put to ourselves. In those we have to agree. The questions are there. Namely, first of all, I think the question which must be there is to see what I said here, that we see the chapter on prayer as the one prayer. I think we must consider this question. Is it true that there is one principle of prayer or not? Because that's so important. If there is only one principle of prayer, then from this moment on until the end of our eternal life... That's a good one. We know that we can only pray one way. And that's the principled way. Then, we must ask ourselves, question 55, the word of the word. Can I see that this epitome of the scriptural notes are really the leading tone or the leading attitude through the whole prayer? See, if the word as the word, which is characterized as mind, spirit, soul, which is characterized there as desire, the expression of the desire, reaching out for God as He is, for the divine nature as it is, these three, if that is the attitude, the overall tone of the chapter, then this attitude should really pervade through the whole chapter. Should be really that which is woven into the whole chapter and not just come up just spasmodically. It should really be something which in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of symbolism and so on, just is woven through the whole text. And then we come to the next question, the seven subjects of prayer. How could we summarize in a few words the seven subjects of prayer depicting the means of prayer? I call them, in distinction to the word as the word, which is the attitude of prayer, I call the seven the means through which we pray. The attitude is the word as the word. I feel that I try to find a word. And the seven prayers, the means through which I pray. B, can we see the developing sequence in these seven subjects? And can we see their irresistible order? Can we see, that's what I would like you to think over, can we see how the fifth prayer couldn't be at the fourth place? Can we see that the sixth prayer couldn't be at the second place? Can we see that they can only be at that place where they are? That's important. That's super important. It's so practical. You see, that's nothing academic. It's super important. It's practical because if I want to have that prayer of healing, where I need the consciousness of the Father, well, I jolly well must know what the content of consciousness must be. And the content, the form of consciousness is really depicted and is really built up through the first five prayers. So I can't start with that if in some measure, in some way, in my life, and my whole attitude, the preceding elements of that prayer has not been cultured. So it's very practical. It's just as I told you yesterday, how at the beginning of the second thousand year period, they failed because they tried to take the vision of the first thousand period and wanted to make it practical at once. Wanted to take it down to the human at once. And they failed it. They made just one wicked world. They took the sons of God and mixed them with the daughters of men, and all what came out was one big muddle of wickedness. And that's usually what happens if we take a vision and just take that vision and want to make it practical. The practical is the fifth day, is the day where Jesus came, the 5,000-year period, and to make it practical we jolly well have to go through the order. And to first substantialize that vision in us and be perseverant in that vision, make it our own so that it is identical with our whole makeup, and it must become an attitude which pervades everything and is not just posmatic here a little and there a little. Then we are ripe for the fifth period where Jesus came and made it practical. The vision is practical. That's true. But it must be ordered. And it comes only in the ordered sequence. So that's why I always like to see the ordered sequence, because you know that definition of Professor Boronowski, which says, well, the knowledge of millions of facts are not scientific until they are put into relation to each other. Then they become scientific facts to us.